all for today's podcast. For more news and analysis, head over to therealnews.com. Thanks for joining us.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Well, you know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah, 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 yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on, come on.
Say you will.
Say it better, yeah. Come on now. Say that you love me. Say that you need me. Say that you want me. You want
live from New York City, it's the Gary Knowles Show. And now, your host, Gary Knowles.
I still remember.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Today, we're going to load you up with information, hopefully inspiration, insight, the latest on health and healing, including how the Western diet depletes artery-protecting immune cells. I'll explain that. My guest in the second part of our program is Professor Mark Crispin Miller. We're going to talk about propaganda and censorship of alternative media and the Internet. He is the professor of media and culture and communications at New York University, where he specializes in modern propaganda. And boy, are we getting propagandized. I'll also be giving a commentary today from Media Benjamin from Alternet on Don't Believe the Media Hype About This Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He's visiting the United States now. And there is a massive campaign on the Internet try to make us believe he's a reformer, he's a good guy. Well, we'll see how much of a good guy he is. Almost all of it shows that he's not. Also today, we have some very interesting audio clips. Continuing with our new series on inspiring a new type of feminism, the third wave, where it's not about men against women, women against men. Rather, it's men and women working cooperatively together for equality, sharing their strengths, and understanding weaknesses. That has not been the case because of who's been excluded from the discussions. But we're going to go back in time. We're going to go back and have a debate between Arianna Huffington and Camilla Paglia from 1994. Now, you can agree or disagree with anything that each of them had to say. They each make their points, and then look at where we are today. Also, from the Ultra Spiritual Life episode, how to be more addicted to your phone. And then, time permitting, just before my next guest, one of the greatest, certainly the most intelligent and honest investigative journalist, documentarians, John Pilger. He is on a simple platform sharing his insights why don't believe all that you hear that's negative about Russia. Russia, Russia, Russia. He explains why it's almost all propaganda, including the current poisoning of a former Russian oligarch who is now in Great Britain. As you see, we have a lot to share. We always begin with health. From La Jolla Institute for Allergy and Immunology, they show how a diet, which is the typical American diet, high in fat, high in cholesterol, how that depletes the ranks of artery-protecting immune cells, turning them into promoters of inflammation. And you've heard me mention many times that at the base, the cause of so many of our illnesses, diabetes, cancer, dementia, arthritis, is inflammation. That in turn exacerbates atherosclerotic plaque buildup, and that occurs in cardiovascular disease. And when your arteries become clogged, the blood has to go so hard in pressure to get through that it can break off little pieces of this plaque, and that can cause an ischemic episode. The team also found that high-density lipoproteins, the HDLs, more commonly known as the good cholesterol, counteract this process, and that's good. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Communications. So here's the takeaway message. Inflammation is the key contributor to the hardening and narrowing of our arteries, our number one killer. And that leads to atherosclerosis. That's a condition that can lead to heart attack and stroke. It's silent. You won't know your arteries are hardening. You won't know that they're being blocked. You won't know that you have inflammation. You won't know that C-reactive protein and fibrinogen and homocysteine are all elevated, and that contributes to your early death. Heart attacks and strokes more often than not, but also cancer. So change your diet and change your chances of having a heart attack or stroke. It's that simple. It's not complicated. Sitting and physical inactivity can increase the risk of urinary tract problems. This is Kangbuk Samsung Hospital in South Korea, published in the British Journal of Urology. Just prolonged sitting and low physical activity are linked with the development of lower urinary tract symptoms. Now, how long is long? If you sit for more than 2 hours at a time, that's too long. Now look at pilots. Look at people who are frequently flyers. Look at people who do long commutes in the morning and then back in the evening, then go to their work and then sit there. Far more likely to have urinary tract problems. So, a simple solution. Every hour, just stand at your desk and do a three-quarter squat. You spread your legs to the width of your shoulders. You bend your knees and you just gently go down. Then push back up on your toes. So you're getting your calf and your behind the muscles, the glutes, the hamstrings, you're pulling them all. And then it's contracting, releasing. So that simple two-minute exercise increases circulation to the micro areas, and that helps prevent varicosities, varicose veins, and spider veins. And it also prevents cramps in the legs. So one more way to help you. And from Boston University School of Medicine, published in the Journal of Gerontology, they found that if you have parents that are living a longer life, you in turn have a sense of meaning and direction in life, and that allows you to live a longer life and experience less disease, less disability, less cognitive impairment. This is an important study, in my opinion. Here's what it says, quote, aging well is not only escaping or delaying disease. Feeling good about your life is important and should be considered an important aspect of healthy aging. So that's important. Now, what does that mean for just everyday people? It means when you wake up in the morning. Do you have a career or do you have a job? Most people don't have careers. We have a professional class that does. Now, those are not a few people. Those are 17.2 million careerists, doctors, lawyers, engineers, architects, CPAs. These are people who did advanced study and mastered the field to where they can apply their skills, and they earn more than a living wage. They have a high-quality standard of living. They're what we call the upper middle class. Generally, they're not millionaires, but over time, they will probably accumulate about $3 million in assets between the appreciated value of their home, providing they don't have debts against that home, and their savings. They certainly spend more than what they should. Now, that is 17 million. That's a lot of people, actually. But then here's the downside of that. They get so tied up into their careers, it's not unusual for people to, including, by the way, a career could be a small business person. You can be your own entrepreneur. 60 to 80 hour work weeks. Literally going home exhausted at night. Sacrificing quality time with the people you love. From your pets to your spouse to your kids. But you think, okay, at this time in my life, I'm making this sacrifice, but I at least have enough money I can hire a tutor, I can hire nannies, I can hire people to help with the house cleaning, and next thing you know, you have all these service people coming into your life, and you're paying them, which means you have to make enough money to keep paying for all these services. And then you end up having kids, more often than not, there's certainly exceptions to this, about 10%, but it means 90% of kids have friends who may be rich. They're 10 million millionaires. Now that means they have $1 million, not excluding their real estate. So they can send their kid to university, NYU at $67,000 or whatever it is a year, plus buy him an apartment for those years they're going to be in the city. It doesn't stress them. They have that kind of disposable income. They can vacation anywhere in the world. They can go down to Soho, which has a lot of designer boutiques, and buy a Louis Vuitton handbag for $5,000. Now, here's the problem. If you're rich and you can do that, what you buy is really meaningless. Beyond about $90,000 a year income, earning more does not improve your happiness or security or state of mind. And that's why, and I can tell you this from personal experience, I've counseled members of the ruling families, I've counseled the most famous names in the history of Hollywood, going clear back to the founding of Hollywood, you know, Gloria Swanson. She was a friend. Hedy Lamarr. Greta Garbo. I mean, there's a whole lot. Now, I mentioned their names because they said it was fine, and, you know, we did shows together and did projects together, but 3,000 people, I won't mention their names because they did not go public. And they will tell you that at a certain point, if you're insecure, all you do is try to make more money. Even when you have more than you could spend, and it does not bring you happiness. But up to a certain amount, it can, because then you're no longer on the street, you're no longer homeless, you're no longer without food or clothes, your kids have the basics. It is important, but we had that at a lesser level, at $30,000 in the 1940s, or 50s, 60s, and 70s. Now it's around $90,000 for family. So let's say that you're one of the 17 million upper mobile careerists. Now, consider this. The careerists are working really hard. And they have almost no time, but they're sure the day will come when they will have time. And so they miss out on very important changes and transitions in life. They might show up, but they're looking at their cell phone, and they got meetings. And if you're a kid, you begin to think that, wow, I'm just another possession in my family's life. I'm given things, but never the unconditional time of the parent. The kids don't forget that, by the way. Just remember that. You'll see that in how they act later in life, the majority. So now you got 100 million people in the United States who are living beyond their means. They could live within their means, but that's not going to happen. That's almost never going to happen. Because the moment you're a careerist, everything is about furthering your career. It's all about going up that ladder, and you can become ruthless, you become insensitive to how you get ahead. Everything's in the next deal, lawyers overbilling their clients. Oh, yeah, it happens all the time. I've had it happen. I fired the lawyers that I have lawyers on my staff full time. If I find that they're making any other counts, and they will, they're gone. You think there's some ethics. There isn't. and doctors showing procedures. We just had some arrested in New York last week for giving a particular type of opiate. They got money. One of them got $300,000. Do you think every doctor is ethical? Wrong. So that's what happens when you frequently become a careerist. And one thing in particular, I noticed how many women thought, I've got everything. I've got success. I'm acknowledged. I'm high up in my group, whatever that group is, and publishing and media. I need a kid. I'll get a kid. Well, is it having a kid? That's like what? Sure, it's like purchasing a new purse. Not quite. And then one day, I'm seeing that kid who's bouncing off the walls, has had everything that money could buy. But money doesn't buy you love. And how many parents thought it did? Big mistake. And now your kid's on all kinds of medications, wants to kill you, and is thinking of killing themselves. This is very common. This is rampant. This is pandemic, the despising of parents by kids who were spoiled rotten because no one ever asked, what does a kid need, not want, need to grow up healthily? So now you got all those kids from all those parents, and what kind of decisions do you think those parents who are careerists are going to make? More often than not, not good choices. Yet we like to believe that as long as you have a career, you're on top of things. And then you look at who's really holding everything together. More often than not, it's the working class people who still remember and still maintain ethics and their culture and their community social responsibilities are far deeper, far more profound in helping a child develop than the rich and the powerful, with some exceptions. It's just part of what that was talking about. So does your kid have a purpose? Do you have a purpose? What is that purpose? Is it a selfish purpose? Is it a purpose that also looks at the needs of other people? Is the world a better place because you were born? Or you're just one more person taking whatever you can take, steal whatever you can steal, lie wherever you can lie, use wherever you can use, manipulate as much as you can? Well, that's all of Washington, D.C., isn't it? That's most of corporate America. And then you start to realize maybe we should have gone to trade school instead of having all these careerists that we then say are the best people to lead us, guide us, the technocrats. Think again on that. Finally, from São Paulo State University in Brazil, vitamin D might be the key to the syndrome affecting half of women age 50 and over. That's tens of millions of women. And because that's the group most susceptible to metabolic syndrome. That's a cluster of conditions we talk about with a heightened risk of heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. And 50% of all women in the United States suffer from that postmenopause. What's that single nutrient they're not getting? Vitamin D. It's easy to get vitamin D. 2,000 to 3,000, 4,000 units a day would help you, and we're not getting it. So all the women, make sure you're getting your vitamin D. It can help prevent osteoporosis. It can help with a lot of things. I'm Gary Noll. We have a lot of program to share with you. We're going to take a break and come right back, and we're going to come right back into hearing from, let's go to how to be more addicted to your phone from the Ultra Spiritual Life. Back in a moment.
Studies show that people check their phones 150 times per day. This is horrible, and I think we can do better. I envision a world where people have enough anxious energy that they're driven to check their phones at least 600 times per day. My mission in this life is to make sure that every man, woman, and child has their life enriched by always having a device in their hand. Always being on my phone gives me the thrill of being manically busy while I'm actually wasting my time. You need to be hypervigilant about what's going on in your feed. If there's something happening that you don't know about, then other people know something useless that you don't know. And that'll make you a less significant person.
If I'm not frantically consuming content on my phone, then I'm missing out. And I don't know what that something is that I'm missing out on, but I refuse to miss out on it.
You need to have a well-educated understanding of how bad things will get if you're not on your phone.
One time I went an hour without looking at my phone. What happened? My family disowned me. I'll never see them again. My dog died. I went bankrupt. And my food supply was cut off.
I get to feel a dopamine rush that gratifies me for 37 seconds each time I check my phone. And then I feel anxious again. And then I check my phone again. Notice that the thoughts and feelings that you don't want to experience are in here. So you'll want to position your phone here. And when you do, notice that your eyes are pointed at your phone. And that keeps your attention out here, which means you're not paying attention to what's going on in here, which is ideal. And I'm sorry to get graphic, but look what would happen if you don't have your phone in front of you. Your attention would start to notice you. And if that happens, it's nobody's fault but your own. Remember, when you're mindlessly scrolling, you're not looking for something you care about. Looking is what you care about. When a text comes in, understand that if you don't check it right away, you become irrelevant to the person who sent it. You simply won't matter to them anymore. At this point, your anxiety levels should be at least a 9 out of 10. This will inspire you to appropriately disrupt what you're doing and check your text, and avoid getting lost in a sea of irrelevance. Okay, go ahead. When you're encountering something wonderful, it can't bring you joy unless you hold your phone between you and it, to transfer it to your social media. Once it's on your social media, you can see other people seeing you see something wonderful, and that'll bring you real joy. You know you're on the right track when other people take out their phone and then you reflexively take out yours, even though you have no idea what you want to look at, and it doesn't matter. Just start looking. How can people live without being on their devices constantly? According to history, if you look at times where people existed without mobile devices, you'll see that they're all dead now, which proves you can't live without being on your device constantly.
Scientific studies show that if I'm not posting useless thoughts that involve no thoughtfulness throughout the day as a way of begging people to notice me, people will forget about me and I'll cease to exist. I don't want to be a statistic.
For safety reasons, you'll always want to have a backup battery charger with you. Would astronauts go to outer space without backup oxygen? No, they would not, because they would die. So what would happen to you if your phone ran out of power? Something worse. You'd experience yourself. If I had kids, I'd give them a phone as soon as they could hold it.
You do have kids. There's two of them.
Really? I've never noticed them. There's a whole world inside your phone. Don't let it pass you by. With the information contained in this inspirational message, you're now capable of being...
Now, we're going to go to a debate from 1994 between Arianna Huffington and Camilla Paglia. You can agree or disagree, but it's important that we hear from two people who held substantially different views. They also were engaged in different realms of the political spectrum. Richard Gale's online now. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Richard, this is a part of a new series that we started yesterday with Camille talking about why men should stop being blamed for all the problems in women's lives, and we should start looking for the underlying real cause of our problems and what we can do to solve them together. We're going to show this because this really shows the combatants how down and dirty it got. And we're going to be bringing people, the women on, who are more spiritual, who don't look at blame and fighting one another, but solving problems together. What did your background research show you on Arianna's background that brings in some perspective?
Well, you know, Arianna is a very complex person. You know, she's originally Greek. You know, and people probably know her as having been the co-founder of the Huffington Post, but what people may not know is that her co-founder was Andrew Breitbart, We've heard of Breitbart News. We probably all know the name Steve Bannon, who took over Breitbart News after Andrew died. And so she has a long history of being a staunch Republican and conservative throughout the 80s and 90s. She ran as a candidate for governor in California in 2003. She's listed by Forbes as one of the, I think, number 12 most influential woman in the media, and 52nd is the most powerful woman in the world. She has a long history going back of attacking the women's liberation movement. Back as early as 1973, she was arguing that only lesbians would benefit from the liberation movement. She's gone after that little more radical contingent of feminists. In terms of her dark past, she's written many books, but on three different accounts, she's been accused of plagiarism. Twice settled in courts, once concerning a book she wrote about Picasso, and another time a book she wrote about the gods and deities of ancient Greece. She does hold some positions that are non-Republican, for example, the renewable energy. She has kind of a New Age spirituality, not a Christian spirituality. She dated Werner Erhard, the founder of ESSE, for a while. Well, that's pretty much about her. I think the other controversy was that when she sold AOL, or sold Huffington Post to AOL for $350 million, some years back, a lot of people felt completely betrayed because she was able to pocket so much of it, and yet Huffington Post was built on really citizen journalism. I mean, anybody could, psychologists and, even people like Deepak Chopra and others and political, politicos and all were able to post there and get exposure, and that's what made Huffington Post. But there was no recognition for all the effort and work that they gave, and many big names they gave over to the Huffington Post. So that was a controversial thing with them. Does he want to know about Paglia?
Let's listen to the debate, then we'll learn about her. We're going right now to the debate.
Please ascend the podium, and Arianna Huffington has a minute and a half to make an opening remark.
The last time I took part in a firing line debate was 24 years ago at the Cambridge Union. I was speaking on the side of Ken Galbraith against Bill Buckley. And ever since, I have been praying to God to speak on the same side as Bill Buckley. And finally, tonight, God has granted me, she has granted me this opportunity. 30 years ago, Betty Friedan launched the women's movement with a feminine mystique at the same time that Lyndon Johnson launched the Great Society. 30 years later, we can look back and say that both the women's movement and the Great Society were spectacular disasters. They maintained the big lie that government, the federal father up in the sky, is going to take care of all social disputes and kiss away every economic boo-boo. They contributed to the breakup of the American family. And they also contributed to the politicization of American life. 30 years later, we look around and divorce rates have tripled. Illegitimacy among teenagers has gone up 400%. Violence against women, rape, are worse than ever. So what has happened? What has happened to that marvelous social experiment that so completely failed? What has happened, as some might argue on this side of the aisle, is that somewhere along the way the women's movement went wrong. Well, I'm arguing that the women's movement was born wrong. It was born on the wrong side of the ideological tracks, and it was born on the wrong side of history. It was born on the wrong side of history, as I argued in my first book, The Female Woman, 20 years ago, because it glamorized, it idealized the masculine realm. It idealized what it is like to have power, success, to make it in the world. And therefore, it ignored what today we need more than ever, the feminine realm of soul, spirit, compassion, heart, and empathy. Thank you.
Don't go away. Thank you very much. Ms. Carver, you have a minute and a half to make an opening remark.
I'm very honored to be here in the presence of Betty Friedan, who indeed changed history. I'm known as someone who has many deep criticisms of the women's movement, but what I have constantly said is that if we could return to what Betty Friedan was saying at the beginning, we would be on the right track. I was born in 1947 into that horrible, repressive, domestic era of the 1950s that Betty Friedan ended with her great book, The Feminine Mystique. And I feel that my generation of the 60s went through. There were many, many excesses that we committed, but essentially, feminism remains one of the great progressive reform movements of the last 200 years. It is analogous to the abolition of slavery, to the abolition of child labor, and so on. Just as Mr. Buckley would not want to abolish Catholicism because of the excesses of certain fanatics, so must we not attribute to feminism the excesses of various neurotics and incompetents who have been swept into it underneath the table, as it were. For me, I believe that feminism is about equal opportunity for women and men in society. But I do agree that certain members of the movement have neglected areas outside the social realm. This is simply part of what we must do to rectify feminism, to bring a kind of narrow little steering thing to bring it back on track. But I remain 100% committed to this movement, which has liberated women. Women will never go back in the closet again.
Thank you. Don't go away. Ariana Huffington, you're now interrogated to your colleague.
Camille, you have argued very eloquently that there are two realms in culture, the Apollonian and the Dionysiac, the rational and the intuitive, the spiritual, whatever words you want to apply to that. And yet the women's movement has exclusively glorified the rational, the masculine. And whatever the results of that, however glorious they may have been in the past, wouldn't you consider the possibility that right now, as our culture needs more than anything, to rediscover the spiritual, the intuitive, the emotional, all qualities that are very identified with the feminine?
Well, Ariana, I totally agree with that, but you see, the women's movement is actually split. There is one part of the movement which glorifies achievement in the social realm, the woman with the attaché case as the ultimate human person. I, too, have a great disagreement with that. But there's another part of the movement, a separatist part, that glorified the goddess and the irrational and the intuitive. So actually, there's a kind of chaos, I think, in the movement for the last 15 years or so. But we need much more dialogue. We need much more discourse of a rational kind. But I agree with you. There are serious flaws in the current Western idolatry of the career woman.
But even tonight, as Betty Friedan was giving her opening statement, she idealized work. She idealized the liberation of the woman from home, as though what the woman was liberated into was this glamorous 9-to-5 existence. And the idea of women not being as depressed as they were is absolutely pathetic. There are more women on Prozac, there are more women on Valium than there have ever been. They may be less depressed because they're on so many drugs. Because...
Well, I agree with you, Ariana, that in point of fact, certain elements in the women's movement have gone too far, and there has been a kind of denigration of the role of woman and mother. I agree with that. But feminism at its best is all about options. When I was growing up in the 1950s, I was the only young girl who even dreamed of a career. It was assumed that you had to date, you had to marry. It was a horrible, repressive, totalitarian regime in America at that time. I think that at that point you were in your native Greece and not in America. But I remember...
Which was a very liberated country, yes.
Correct, and I'm often saying that we need a little more of the sort of Mediterranean woman's moxie into the Anglo-Saxon woman's movement.
Let's move to another subject for a minute. You have identified yourself as a Clinton Democrat. You were once in favor of the Clinton health care bill, and you are proud of that, or maybe less proud now than you were then, but nevertheless, you're public about it. The whole women's movement has been identified with this big government mentality. They do look to big government constantly to solve women's problems, despite the amazing failures of big government. A definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing again and again, expecting different results. I would say this is also a definition of the women's movement. Would you agree?
I agree with you that... I agree with you that there has been an excessive partisanship on the part of many women in the feminist movement. I myself am a Clinton Democrat. I look forward to voting for Clinton again. However, despite all... but I want George Stephanopoulos fired immediately. I want the whole White House staff fired. But I do feel that there should be room in feminism for Republican women and for pro-life women as well. So I agree, but those have been errors of the leadership. Again, we cannot dismiss the entire women's movement because of errors of the leadership.
You have just demonstrated one of the main cornerstones of the women's movement, which is blame. Clinton is okay. His staff is at fault. You know, let's fire everybody at the White House. Clinton is okay. It's the same thing with the whole... You know, the whole women's movement mentality is always that somebody else is to blame. It's never the women themselves. If it's date rape, it was never anything the woman did. And you yourself have argued that brilliantly. Mm-hmm. So I would really like to ask you... Mm-hmm. I would really like to ask you right now to do something which maybe has never happened before on Firing Line, but you always like to make news. And this is to cross over to our side. Because you... If nothing else, wouldn't you love to see the look on Michael Kinsley's face?
I have to tear up my program here.
Unfortunately, I cannot because the resolution says the women's movement has been a disaster, and I feel the women's movement, despite many errors, despite many excesses, is still an overwhelming success.
All right. On that note, if you're not going to cross over to the other side, you can start interrogating the other side.
Ariana, I could ask you the same thing. Why aren't you on this side? Because in your book on Picasso, you took a tack which I have been critical of the feminist leadership for taking. That is, you say that we cannot take Picasso seriously as a great artist because of the way he treated women in everyday life. So how that position seems so doctrinaire feminist. How can you defend that and yet be on that side?
Well, I'm sure you haven't read my book, because that's not exactly what I said. What I said is much worse. I said that Picasso, although a great genius, was not one of the greatest artists who ever lived, not just because of the way he treated women in life and in art, but because of the way he denied the existence of something transcendent, because of the way that he was unable to give us a glimpse of the light through the darkness. And what I argued is that all great artists, whether Shakespeare or Mozart or anybody you would care to mention, even as they exposed the darkness, they were also able to give us a glimpse to the light. And that's really one of my problems with the women's movement as well, because it's a very secular movement. Mm-hmm. And I personally do not believe that there can be ultimately important, profound solutions to our problems without reconnecting with God, with the divine, and with the spiritual element in our lives.
But... But Ariana, there's an enormous part of the women's movement in America that that is constantly talking about spiritual values. Unfortunately, it's a big mess intellectually. It's one of the areas of feminism that I'm trying to clean up. To me, it's often a big pile of manure. But there's a whole wing, a very strong wing associated with Mary Daly and so on. It is extraordinarily separatist. It involves often white witchcraft and worship of the goddess of nature. And there's a kind of...
White witchcraft is not my idea of spirituality, incidentally.
Well, there's a vision of God as she surely you realize that a lot of these reforms of the language of the Bible, which I totally oppose on historical grounds, is the rewriting of the language of the Bible so that there are gender neutral phraseology and so on. That's coming from the spiritual wing of feminism. So I feel that you are blaming feminism in fact this is one of the most dominant wings within it.
Well, certainly not in my experience, and certainly not in the way that the women's movement is perceived. You yourself have described yourself as an atheist. I don't know whether you still hold to that opinion. I know your opinions tend to change every week. But what matters here is, for me, the recognition that what our culture is missing more than anything is that element of the spiritual, because ultimately that's where our caring for each other comes from. When the founding fathers created this country, when the Constitution was first written, at the heart of it is that belief that there is a God, that there is something larger than ourselves, and that that's what ultimately unites us. And I believe that without rediscovering that source of caring for others, without moving beyond our own self-centeredness, which dominates the women's movement, we'll never be able to solve the so-called women's problems. And even more importantly...
Okay. You can hear the rest of the debate online, but that's just to give you an idea of two of the more powerful and articulate persons within the women's movement. And what would be the difference in that debate versus two of the people that I mentioned the other day, mentioning about 25 different women that you never see on television and never hear from, but have a lot to share when it comes to helping resolve many of the problems we faced in the world today, from wars and starvation and authoritarianism. So we're going to be sharing those with you. Richard, we're going to go to our guests now, but very quickly, give us any final insights you have, since we didn't have a chance before, on Camille Paglia.
Oh, no. Camille Paglia is one of our great, you know, feminists, or some might call an anti-feminist intellectuals in America, regarding so many social criticism, modern culture, and film industry, you know, the roles of matriarchy, androgyny, homosexuality. But I think somebody wants to kind of get a good appreciation for her. She kind of comes very much out of that French existentialist tradition, you know, like Jean-Paul Sartre or Gaston Bachelard. But she goes on the offensive of all of them. Naomi Wolf, Gloria Steinem, Carol Gilligan, Zoe Baird, Hillary Clinton. I mean, you know, there's nothing sacred to her as far as when it comes to social criticism of people's views.
Good. Thank you, Richard. We will be having some of the world's great female minds on this program to share their thoughts on going forward a new form of feminism. Let's now go over and say hello to Professor Mark Crispin Miller. And as I mentioned earlier, he is Professor of Media, Culture, and Communications at New York University, where he specializes in modern propaganda, history of advertising, film, and major media. He is also the lead chief editor of the series Forbidden Bookshelf, which republishes important books that have been censored or banned or ignored or wrongly criticized in the course of American history. From I.F. Stone and Lewis Mumford and Peter Dale Scott and Christopher Simpson, among others. He has his master's and doctorate degrees from Johns Hopkins University, and he's written and contributed to many books, including Loser Take All, as well as Fooled Again, which covered election fraud. And his website is markcrispinmiller.com. Nice to have you with us today, Mark.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Mark, just today I saw at least three different postings on the Internet showing how the current visit, a two-week visit in the United States, where the crown prince of, and soon to be, as soon as his father dies, the king of Saudi Arabia, he's only 32 years old, where he is a reformer. He's going to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood and the 20,000 of their preachers and get them out of education. And that way it's going to clean up the country so women can go to theaters again, et cetera. And at the same time that we're supposed to buy, he's a reformer, and therefore Silicon Valley's waiting to see him this week, and members of Congress are praising him, and MIT's featuring him in a speech. And, of course, everyone at the White House is happy to see him. It denies all the things he is doing, and I'd let you to tell us what he is doing and why he's not a reformer, but that's one way that propaganda convinces us that we should do whatever he wants. And he wants to also build 20 nuclear power plants in this country. Instead of looking, he's in the desert. Why not use solar? Why not use wind? Instead, he wants nuclear, the worst type of energy you could put in a country. And no one is being critical of him in the mainstream media. Your thoughts, please.
Well, yeah, that's putting it mildly. It's funny you should mention this, because I'm holding today's New York Times. You know, increasingly feel the need to hold it with surgical gloves on, if you know what I mean, because it's such a toxic rag. But I'm looking at the front page, and on the lead story over on the right is President's call to Putin dodges talk of foul play. So the point of this, you know, lead front page story in the Times is that there's major news in the fact that when Trump called Putin to congratulate him on his victory at the polls in Russia, he failed to put it to him about his interference in our election. The subhead, no discussion of 2016 meddling in U.S. or attack on ex-spy. Okay. Right next to that, in the top middle of the page, is a photograph of Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi Arabia's crown prince, sitting with Trump in the Oval Office. White House welcome. Saudi Arabia's crown prince was hosted by President Trump on Tuesday. This is just one example of the kind of bizarro experience we're having nowadays in the U.S., where the propaganda has really kind of pulled us all through the looking glass. Because on the one hand, we have an indignant pseudo-news story that assails Trump for congratulating Putin on his electoral win without bringing up either of two crimes that Putin allegedly committed, the attack on the spy in Salisbury, England, and the meddling in the U.S. election, two crimes for which we have yet to see a shred of evidence, and in fact, crimes that were very likely never committed at all, because there's a wealth of counter-evidence in both cases. At the same time, we're shown a picture of Trump welcoming this guy, Mohammed bin Salman, the 32-year-old crown prince of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, a medievalist kingdom, a monarchy, which engages in the most brutal kind of repression of human rights, you know, flogging dissidents, beheading prisoners, clearly sponsoring the most radical kind of jihadist terrorism all over the Middle East. And somehow that this is okay, and Trump's not criticized for welcoming this guy, who right at the moment, as you obviously know, for a reformer, is engaged in the rather dubious practice of arresting and torturing many of his peers until they turn over their assets to him. You know, it's a kind of brutal gangster shakedown that he's carrying out, and this guy, you know, this guy is supposedly a reformer. I mean, you know, it's staggering to me. But it's entirely typical of what we get from our so-called free press nowadays.
Just this morning, I watched John Pilger, one of the, in my opinion, one of the most responsible journalists of the last half century, and he was saying, "Where is the evidence? The actual hard evidence that it was Russia and Putin's agents that tried to kill this former Russian and his daughter, and there is no evidence." And yet the American media immediately has, as does the English media, that yes, they're guilty, and therefore they need to be punished even more. And then look at all of the missiles that are surrounding the western part of Russia, and look at the beating of the drums of war that Hillary Clinton was proposing, and now that is high up on the agenda, this whole war agenda of the deep state. Could you discuss how the deep state has been able to have undue influence over our domestic and foreign policies, and the mainstream media has gone along with it and never exposed it?
Yeah. Well, that's a tall order, but I think I can do it simply by referring to something that happened here 55 years ago this November. I mean, the dilemma that you're, or the predicament that you're describing, I think can be dated to that moment when the president of the United States was, you know, had his head blown off at high noon in the streets of Dallas, Texas. This was obviously a coup carried out by the military and the CIA with, you know, quite a range of accomplices, you know, including the mob and so on. This was, you know, an obvious crime of the highest kind that was essentially denied as a conspiracy at the time and ever since by the corporate media and even by much of the left press. That it was a blow from which this democracy actually never recovered, to the point that it isn't really even remotely a democracy today. It's an oligarchy. Kennedy was killed because of his intention to withdraw troops from Vietnam, to dial down the Cold War, to stop the nuclear arms race, and to, in quite an impressive range of ways, to cut the power of the rich and Wall Street, so on. He wanted to unmake the CIA. I mean, the list is a long one. It was really revolutionary, and he was killed for that reason. He would have sailed to re-election. He would have attracted votes across the color line. The same was true of Bobby Kennedy, his brother, who was killed 5 years later. In a different way, the same was true of Martin Luther King, who in the final year of his life had shifted from an exclusive focus on civil rights to a much more radical politics. He was the first public figure in America to come out against the war in Vietnam. He had shifted from an emphasis on race alone to class considerations because he was, you know, supportive of this major garbage man strike in the South. And we can even include in this company of important figures, seminal figures, Malcolm X, who was killed in 1965 and who also had the potential to attract a far broader range of American supporters because he had moved away from the Afrocentrism of his, you know, most notorious years toward a much more inclusive vision. And his, you know, I mean, one goes back and looks at the things he was saying at the time, one is really struck by how bold and radical he really was and how many forbidden topics he was broaching. So these four figures, and they weren't the only ones, but these four major figures, I believe, were all assassinated because each had the potential to mobilize a significant percentage, a significant range of the American grassroots in favor of a vision that really would have changed things. I believe that those murders, which have been consigned to the category of iconic events of the 60s, I believe that those four murders really set us on the path toward this current moment, where we're embroiled in endless wars abroad, where a supposedly liberal and quasi-progressive president actually embroiled the United States in five wars more than the ones that Bush-Cheney had started. We have unprecedented income inequality. Our economy is much more like the economy of a country like Brazil, you know, with an ever-growing underclass and an ever-wealthier and tinier elite at the top. I mean, I could go on, but the point is, I think that to answer your question after that kind of long-winded historical essay, the point is that we have been moving in this direction for a long time, and now are at the point where, you know, serial election theft and media concentration have enabled an utterly corrupt political elite, and that includes both parties, to kind of dominate the political system in a way that has nothing to do with the will of the electorate. And we can get into the subject of election theft, which, you know, I've written a great deal about, because that's a crucial element here. You know, the nullification of electoral democracy that took place so spectacularly on November 22nd, 1963, has simply continued ever since. And in the last few decades, in a less explosive and dramatic way than it happened in Dallas on that day, through, you know, rampant vote suppression and computerized election fraud. But the fact of the matter is that we are not living in a democracy any longer, and our free press is not functioning in anything like the way the framers had in mind when they came up with the First Amendment. The press is an inexhaustible fount of propaganda, I think generated by what you're calling the deep state, which has now sunk its talons deeply into the political system and the media, and I would add into academia, to the point that, you know, I can't say anything other than the fact that we need some kind of revolution.
Final question. I appreciate that answer. Thank you. Short answer on this because we're coming up near the end of the program. Right now, Facebook, Google, are beginning a process. It's actually been going on for about a year to censor or to limit access or eyes on a page to anything they consider conspiratorial. That means
right.
Your work. That means Chris Hedges' work. That means Cornel West's work. All of the good, Seymour Hersh, anyone who's doing good work, who is showing corruption, either through corporate interest or government interest, would now be censored, and they would be taboo, persona
right.
non grata.
That's right.
Your thoughts?
Well, this the Internet is a tremendous threat, a tremendous potential threat to the elites, because it allows people to get information that has not been censored or filtered by the corporate press and much of the left press. For that reason, they are engaged in the process that you've just described, a slow and inexplicit process of shadow banning, you know, whereby all kinds of really vital information and crucial perspectives on that information are being made unavailable to people. So it's not being done through outright banning as in China. It's being done more bureaucratically and technically in a way that many people are unaware is even happening. It has affected me. It has affected the other people you've mentioned, and it has affected many, many others, including a lot of, you know, just grassroots activist investigators, many of them right-wing, who have been digging into things like, you know, Pizzagate or whatever you want to bring up. The fact is that this is a grave threat to free expression and therefore to the survival not only of democracy in this country, but really of the planet, because I'll just end by saying that the things that we talk about the least, okay, because the media has blacked them out, are those that actually pose the gravest threat to us, you know, things that aren't even coming up at all, far more dangerous than the availability of assault weapons, you know, by orders, several orders of magnitude, things like Fukushima, things like vaccination, you know, things like child trafficking. These are subjects we should be talking about, and yet those who try to do so are pilloried as conspiracy theorists trading in fake news and Russian propaganda. That's something that you know, people like you are fighting. I'm trying to fight it, and we just have to keep it up, because the more people know that there's a truth out there, the less susceptible they'll be to this propaganda. And I'll simply end by saying that I can say with happiness that I find and have found over the last several years that my own students, the younger people, used as they are to the Internet, are nowhere near as susceptible to this baloney as older people are. They are not intimidated by the accusation of conspiracy theory. Their minds are open. So it's our obligation to talk to them, because they're the ones we really depend on to get out of this really dire mess we're in.
Mark, thank you very much for being on, and we look forward to our next conversation with you.
Same here. Thank you.
Professor Mark Crispin Miller, he is professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University, where he talks about modern propaganda. We are really in a lot of propaganda wars right now. We will continue to bring you the latest insights into that. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.